your mouth when you're working me.
Naggers, Jews, homosexuals, Mexicans, Arabs, and all kinds of different chanks stink.
I was thinking about how weird it is to be doing this in the middle of the day.
Really? Why?
I don't know. It just doesn't feel right to me.
Okay. That makes...
I don't mean right...
You reject to cite your...
I don't mean right like bad. I just mean it doesn't feel correct.
Okay.
That's all. I feel like this is a different show. This is like the G-rated show.
This is not the G-rated show. This is just the show that's not about porn. That's it.
All right, so...
And I'd like to dedicate this episode to my cousin who passed away ridiculously untimely at 40 from unknown something.
What's his name?
Matthew.
That makes me so sad.
Yeah. Really, really, really funny guy.
When was the last time you saw him?
Last November, last winter camp, and I was down in Fort Lauderdale.
You just had a wonderful shot, and it tasted like what? A Siberry and what?
Tasted like a cat ate an apple and pissed in my glass.
What was it called? Blueberry Delight?
Blueberry Delight.
Okay.
And we did some little videos and shit. That's why I had the thing up on Facebook.
Yeah.
So, sucks ass. Okay, so he's ready. You want to go?
Yeah, sure. Wow. Now I have to switch gears.
Why?
Because we were talking about serious shit.
Hello.
Hey.
Hola.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Where are you?
He's in Canada, but 2 hours back.
Florida. It's only 10 here.
Oh, it's only 10 there. Okay, well, is it like, I know this is going to sound really stupid, but is it still cold there? Does it ever get warm?
This is the stupid American portion of the show.
That is a fair question for Edmonton, Alberta, because we can be at times in the wintertime, the only place colder than us is Siberia. Oh. So, but we are going to reach 30 degrees Celsius today. So that's like...
Wait, what is that Fahrenheit? I don't know the math.
Like yeah. 95, close to 100.
Degrees?
Yeah, the easiest way to do it is double plus 30. That's usually how Fahrenheit
it's
works.
It's going to be 100 degrees there?
Jesus, yeah. Louises.
Oh, that fucking sucks. Oh my God, you guys can't catch a break.
But we don't have the humidity, though, right? So it's dry here.
I mean,
I'm just going to move. I got my little man in a swing behind
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I can be loud and animated, so I don't want to wake him up.
Okay, sure. Well, how old is the baby?
He's getting close to 3 months. He's 2.5 months
okay,
right now.
Okay, and how old are your other children?
My daughter's 9, and my little Tasmanian devil is 3.
9, 3, and 3 months. Wow, yes. Yowza! All right, so I'm just curious because I have 3. Well, what do you? What is it different this time? With the third.
The first one's like glass, second one's like rubber, third one's like as long as you're still breathing, it's all
good. It's so fucking true. My husband and I were just talking about this the other night. We were talking about how we were at the beach, and mine are 11, 9, and 4. And my 4-year-old thinks he's 17. And so we were just laughing about how we're like sitting in our little beach chairs, I'm drinking, you know, laying out, I'm listening to my fucking music, I'm texting people. And my sister and I just looked at each other, we're like, oh my God, like we just let them go. Like, I'm just like, yeah, he's in the ocean. He's fucking fine. I'm texting. I mean, he's 4. She's like, you never would have done that with Eli. I'm like, no, fuck no. With Eli, we probably were strapped to each other, each in personal flotation devices with like a Coast Guard flyby.
No, your first one's always, that's the same. We were just talking about that with Beckham because like we let him cry in the crib so much more. Like we'll be tired in the morning and we're just like, he's not going to die. Yeah. We'll get to him. Whereas with Riley, it was like as soon as they just made a mutter, we're like, what do they need? Do they need diaper change? Do they need like this? You're like, now at this age, it's like, he'll be fine. Like, we had to get our yard all done because we're taking off next week for like our only little bit of vacation for the summer. Well, he's mine because I'm in production.
Right.
And we are getting the yard done and we just left him in the swing crying. Uh-huh. You could hear him through the windows and everything. And we're just like, hey, we have to get it done.
I know, right? I mean, listen, I'm telling you, what's also really interesting to me about this is, because, you know, I was in education for a long time.
Yeah.
So I've worked with kids and I have a master's, and so I know some stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
tell it like it is. I know some stuff.
So the whole birth order thing to me, there are books about it and whatever. I still, even all the time I spent with around children, I kind of didn't buy into it until I really started to see how the birth order affects how my kids' personalities are being shaped, because they're being raised very differently. I'm the same person and I love them all the same, but my middle son's experience is totally different from my third son's experience. My middle son, life was a fucking disaster and he was awful and I just wanted to fucking run away. And you know, with this one, it's like, hey, he's cool. He's fun. He'll go anywhere. He's, you know, whatever. And
there's a total dynamic to that. And I've seen it with other people, because also if you're like the first girl in the family, mm-hmm. or the first boy or something like that too, right? There's a different treatment because mm-hmm. the family hasn't experienced one. Like my daughter's the oldest and we're the first child out of my wife and her sister's mm-hmm. kids. So she kind of gets a little bit, because she was the first, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And then now Ryder was the first boy on my wife's side, because my wife had two sisters. Mm-hmm. Her sister has two girls. We had a girl, so it looked like we were going to have all girls. But now that we have the second boy, it's kind of like, well, now we got two, right? Mm-hmm. So see how he kind of fits in as the first boy. But
well, you know what's really interesting? There's a great book by a guy called Poe Bronson. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. I don't know how much. Poe Bronson, he's a psychologist. And he wrote
Edgar Allan Poe?
Yeah, Poe Bronson, yeah. Okay. And he wrote this really cool book that you should check out called Nurture Shock. And basically, it's all this research that basically negates everything we thought we knew about raising kids and about kids for the last 30 or 40 years. So for example, when we were all growing up, because we all grew up in the 70s and the 80s, it was all about building self-esteem. We want them to feel good about themselves. Tell your children how wonderful they are and tell them how much you love them. And so every time you did anything, it was, oh, great job. That's so amazing. And you know, then we sort of evolved into this culture where we were always praising everybody and telling them how wonderful they are and giving everybody an award and a prize, right?
Yeah.
So that's how we were raised. And what he said is, you know, that raised a generation of people who just expected everything to be handed to them because they just thought they were wonderful just for being wonderful. He said, you have to praise kids and say, like, when my kids come home with good grades, instead of saying, oh my God, you got good grades because you're smart. No, you got good grades because you worked hard.
Yeah.
And how that completely changes the way that we raise kids. And there's another chapter on how everything we always thought about only children was that they grew up to be these horribly maladjusted kids who were narcissists and selfish and didn't know how to interact with other people and whatever. And it turns out that only children are actually more well-adjusted than people with siblings, because people with siblings have all of this sort of politics that they grow up with and birth order and differences in the way they're being raised and sibling rivalry and...
You're all freakonomicsing on us here.
And fighting. So anyway, it's fascinating because you really see how it changes the way people evolve just based on where they're born in their family. So anyway.
that kind of plays into, you know, what we had Dr. Gabor Maté talk about in the Culture High, and sort of shifted into that. But
mm-hmm. Yeah.
About social structure and addiction coming from early childhood development, right? And not so much the substance itself, but looking at that, you know, if you have, you know, and same with Ed Burns, the former Baltimore police detective that we interviewed, mm-hmm. he also was a teacher for a while. And he said that was the toughest thing for him to ever adjust, because he would only get these kids for an hour. And he could say even the hour in the day, I could see I was making an impact, but it wasn't enough where I knew they were going, a lot of things were happening to them in their home life. And he talked about, he had this tree on the wall where he used to get the kids to place themselves on there and how they were feeling that day, where he said, if they were feeling strong, put themselves right around the base of the tree saying, I'm strong today, I'm hanging on. Or if they were barely hanging on because home life was tough, they put themselves on the far branch saying, like, I'm barely hanging today. And then that way he could adjust the way he was teaching, saying, like, okay, I'm going to tread lightly today because you've now established where you are, right? Like, it's been a tough home break for you or something, mm-hmm. so I need to adjust. And it's interesting when you look at that, when he said, you know, even me as a cop, when I started early as my career, I'd kind of be like, oh, these addicts, they need to pull up their bootstraps and get their life together. But how can you if you don't have a good moral compass or guidance at home, right? Mm-hmm. That's easy for people to say from a privileged lifestyle where they have a family that can spend the money on rehab, or they have a good moral compass, whether that's an uncle, a coach, a father, a mother, mm-hmm. to tell them right from wrong, to guide them. But when you don't have that and you come from poor economic situations and then you're caught in the drug game, you know, that is so hard to beat an addiction, right? And that's so when you look at addiction in that way versus looking at it as just the substance, right? Like, oh, you're addicted to a substance, therefore you have a problem.
Oh, God, no. But you were in the middle of a point.
Yeah.
And I was trying to remember how you pronounced the doctor's name again.
Dr. Gabor Maté.
Gabor Maté.
Looks like mate, but he's the guy in the opening of the Culture High that it's probably, for me, it's one of my favorite parts, and it's probably the part of the film. Well, that and Jason David and his son Jaden are the one parts that even the most anti, you know, marijuana people, when they watch that, it's tough for them not to shake their ideology and be like, maybe there is a point being made there that I need to reconsider.
I really like his style, the way that he interjects what he's thinking. He's able to articulate in a very logical way.
Yes, and that, well, he's also,
and tranquil too.
Yeah, he's very approachable.
Well, he's a very, you know, he's world-renowned addiction specialist and speaker. He goes all over and does TED Talks and does speech for thousands of people. So he's really found a way to articulate that, because it's very convoluted to understand that, you know, in the early stages of childhood development, your brain is growing, literally developing neurons and synapses and stuff like that. And you know, that early childhood development, those, and you know, like as he talks about in the film, whether it's, you know, abuse from the parent, divorce, all these different things, actually will develop the brain in such a way that when you get exposed to certain addictive properties in the future, you can become addicted to them because of the way that your brain developed as a youngster.
Right. Well, but what you're talking about, though, it's so interesting because there are so many facets to it, because what you're talking about is white privilege inherently comes from a total and complete lack of empathy and an inability to understand something from another person's perspective. That's what white privilege is all about, because this whole idea of this is how I did it, this is what worked for me, why would that not work for you, is just this completely narcissistic, like one-sided way of looking at things. And that's why we treat addicts the way we do in this culture. And that's why we treat the downtrodden the way we do in our culture, is because we have this expectation that because I was able to pull myself up from my bootstraps in my situation, why can't you?
And I worked hard and this and that. You worked hard when you had a good moral upbringing, right?
Even just a good moral upbringing, because that implies that it has something to do. Did we lose you again?
No,
you're fine. Okay. That it has something to do with the parenting, and that's not what it's about. What it's about is if you live in a community, in a world that is your universe, where you have no example set for you of what it looks like to be successful, of what it looks like to get an education and make that your priority, of what it looks like to have a partner with whom you choose to have children and raise them. When you live in a culture where all you see is, you know, single moms and crime and drugs and whatever, you don't know that anything exists beyond that. So therefore you have nothing to aspire to. And that's what people don't understand.
You know, you hit the nail on the head, and then people will bring up the argument and be like, well, how about people that get addicted and they come from, you know, better economic situations. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, but that still doesn't, you know, having good economic situations doesn't leave out neglect, doesn't leave out verbal abuse. Like, everybody's body reacts differently. Like, I have a very good friend of mine that's now 8 years sober, right? He was addicted to cocaine and booze. And he has such a good grasp on this, where he's like, listen, I didn't come from a broken family, but I had social disorders, I had, you know, anxiety problems, I had trust issues. And those were my things that now I can identify with. He's like, I have no problem. I can go to a nightclub now and hang out with the boys in Vegas, and I have no desire to drink or do drugs, right? Because I now know what my triggers are.
Right.
But what I knew what those were, right? He's like, that was my crutch. He's like, that's why when I got introduced to alcohol and cocaine, for me, it was like, wow, this is everything I was missing in life, right?
Right. And I'll tell you something else just from my own personal experience. And I wrote about this on my blog at one point because I wrote this. I just decided that I had, for some reason, to tell the whole entire world every single deepest, darkest secret that I ever had my whole entire life. And so I wrote this blog. And once I got them all out, I was like, all right, I'm done writing. So anyway, I wrote an entry. One of the entries I wrote was about how, because I had struggled with depression and anxiety and bulimia and all different kinds of addictions to shopping and food and whatever. And part of the reason why I never could break out of it was this, I felt guilty because I had no reason to be fucked up. I wasn't abused. I wasn't neglected. I had really good parents. I went to good schools. Nothing bad ever happened to me. So like, what right did I have to be so fucked up, which actually perpetuated the cycle? And that's what happens, I think, with upper middle class people. That's where their addiction comes from, is this.
And a lot can be from, and I've seen it. Luckily, I didn't have that. I mean, my stepfather worked in the corporate world and was really good about making sure that, you know, although he had a crazy busy schedule, when he was home time, it was all about his boys. Right. But you can see, I mean, neglect can do so much damage, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, your kid wants to see approval. They want that father figure, that mother figure. Mm-hmm. And if you don't go throw the baseball with them occasionally, or you don't go to their hockey game or something like right. that. I mean, I see it right now. I'm the biggest geek for my daughter picked up hockey this year. We didn't think my daughter was going to be a sports person. She mm-hmm. seemed much more artsy. She wants to be a professional YouTuber. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't seem like sports are going to be her thing. But then literally playing hockey, she gets off and she is so mad or depressed if I'm not there to watch her game. I've only wow. missed a few because I've had to be away to shoot. But I can see it now in her development where she wants that approval of not just me, but now she's getting the confidence of playing the sport. Mm-hmm. But I think when she first started, it was like, wow, my dad's so interested in watching me play and mm-hmm. develop these life skills. And I've seen it now in her confidence, not just – I mean, she's getting exactly what you want from a sport. Is like, she started to where she couldn't even skate, and now, you know, she's playing with girls that have played 4 years. Mm-hmm. She's getting the odd goal, of her skating has improved, and she's seeing the confidence come. They're like, wow, like, I'm applying myself and getting better. And she feels, right. and but I can see how, like, if I wasn't there, because every game I'm not there, she'll call me right away mm-hmm. when I'm out of town and be like, oh my God, Dad, you missed my goal. Like, so I can imagine if you were a parent that was never there for that, mm-hmm. what that would do to your kid. They're kind of like, wow, right. I played these sports and like my parent was too busy to even come
well,
watch.
Well, and here's what's interesting.
Or I didn't have a parent at all.
Yeah, or I didn't have a parent at all that gave right. me any kind of, because Riley always asked me after the game, like, and I'll talk to her about the good things. She'd be like, Dad, I scored two goals. I'm like, that's awesome.
Okay.
You know, but I was like, it's not just about scoring goals, right?
I have to stop you for 1 second and ask you, have you taken her to see Inside Out?
No, not yet. We tried.
Okay, do you know that it's about a girl named Riley and she plays ice hockey?
No, I didn't know. They're stealing my
And she's
store.
Like 9 years old. I swear to God. I just saw it today with my kids.
We tried on the weekend, but it
so
was so
you got awesome. You got to you have to go with her to see that movie.
That is one of daddy daughter dates all the time.
No, I know, but this particular film, because it's about a little girl.
Dude, he tried to go see it already.
No,
it was sold out.
But he doesn't know. You don't know this part.
He's gonna still go.
No.
Yeah, I'm pumped to go see it as it is already, but yeah. I can already see the value, you know, me as a parent learning, because that's the other thing you don't know until you're a parent yourself, is that parents don't know it all. They're learning as they go,
too.
Yeah,
we don't know jack shit.
I'm learning everything as we go, but I actually was able to do, because my daughter and I have established that we go to all the animated movies. I think I enjoy them just as much as she does, so it's a very special thing for the two of us. Mm-hmm. But I got her, we just did an interview with Jay Baruchel for my recent movie, Ice Guardians, right? Because he's shooting mm-hmm. Goop 2.
Well, I want to talk to you about that in a minute, too.
He's the voice of Hiccup in How to Train Your Dragon,
okay.
right?
Yeah.
So, smoked about a fucking pound of weed and played a bunch of video games.
Weed is tight. Weed is tight. That's awesome.
That's awesome. Weed yeah. is awesome.
It's like the golfing sequence in Navy SEALs.
Sick reference, though, bro.
Oh, thanks, bud.
Dude, your references are out of control. Everyone knows that.
Hey,
dude.
Thanks.
A cool guy. And I could tell, like, just by the way, he was so down to earth, another Canadian guy. So I was like, hey, Jay. I was like, my daughter and I are both huge fans of the How to Train Your Dragon series. Like, would it be cool if you say I've met? He's like, absolutely. Roll your camera.
That's awesome.
So he said, like, he made a video saying, hey, Riley, you'll probably recognize my voice. Maybe you won't. I usually am a cartoon. I play Hiccup. He's like, and hopefully one day I'll get to meet you and you can come to Burke and we can go for a ride.
And did she lose her mind?
She lost her mind. She brought me to school and showed it off. And she was like,
okay, so I have to.
Wait, real quick.
You're friends with him.
Are you friends with Seth Rogen as well?
No, actually, he turned us down for the call try.
Really?
What?
That doesn't sound. That sounds very un-Seth Rogen-like.
they said just because it was they want to be able to travel across the border easily, so they said they don't want to be involved in anything political with cannabis, which they figured. So I was like, this was before the interview and everything came out, which was super political. But at the time when we interviewed him,
let me ask you this, because we're getting into the kind of the Freakonomics thing earlier. What are your thoughts on what's behind creating the climate, and the life that we could be living in a different way if we weren't spending trillions of dollars on defense of we don't even know.
It's so I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. We have an interesting perspective because we live here in Canada where we're so not militarized, right? Like, we do have military, and actually one of the best Air Force training bases is just like, even the Americans come up here to train. It's just up north here in Canada. But our militaries, we constantly make fun of it. Like, we have like 2 submarines. We don't have 1 battleship. Like, we're small. Like, our Marine, we would get taken out by the U.S. like that if it was, right? Like, we don't have much of a military. I mean, our troops, the limited that we have, are supposed to be very well trained, but we just don't put right. the kind of money. But part of that is because we know that we're like right next door to this huge military presence, that if you mess with Canada,
right.
the U.S. is going to jump in right away because we provide you with a lot of resources, mainly power and water.
Of course you do. Of course you do.
We are a valuable ally. So it's an interesting thing for us where it's like, okay, we can say, yeah, it's great. We're a country that doesn't spend on that. But make no mistake, if we ran into some serious problems, we'd be crying to the United States right away. We need right. your help. You better come in here and kick ass.
Right.
So,
well, I but know. I mean, Canada's sort of like the Switzerland of the Americas, I think.
That's true. I think that's true.
Who's going to fuck with Canada?
it's not as expensive to live there, though.
You have syrup, you have hockey.
So, like, I mean, I don't want to get into, like, I'm not trying to, like, create some, nefarious, conspiracy thing. But in sense of the 1% of the corporations or the upper echelon that kind of sort of controls how the climate is.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you think that, but that's the part that confuses me, because I don't want to be political because I don't believe in the system, but then at the same time, on some level, it exists if it were a real system that was created like in any democratic sense, even though this is not a democracy that we live in. It's a constitutional republic, which everyone keeps saying, democracy, democracy, democracy. It's like, we don't live in a democracy. Yeah. Again, people. Anyway, I'm sorry. You were going to say something.
You went way off.
I went way off, but there being some kind of a climate change that makes these things happen is one of the reasons
when
why
it exists.
When you're
talking about a climate change, you're talking about a change in culture and perception?
Yeah,
and
of course.
And the changes you're talking about?
Politically, in the sense that at some point, people really took a active involvement in voting and that portion, and then it got something got bastardized, and now we're in a system where it's like you get the two of lesser evils. There's not a real way for change to come in.
Donkey one or donkey two.
Yeah, absolutely.
Red or the blue team, exactly. And you get caught up. Well, and again, that's so interesting to watch from a Canadian perspective, because we're much more socialized up here, right? We're social commies trying to take your guns, is like the Americans will sell that, right? Like, we have a several party system. Here we have the NDP, the Conservatives, the Liberals. Like, we have several parties. You don't have to vote for one or the other, right? You can vote for the minority party and help them get more seats, right? You don't have just the two. But not to say our system isn't screwed up too, right? There is fuckery about as well. But we have more of a true democracy.
There is fuckery about. That's going to be a T-shirt with your name on it. That's
it's like the golfing sequence in Navy SEALs. Fuckery afoot.
Yeah, there's always, like, I mean, in the Canadian, we just had, everybody's been questioning the Prime Minister, and we haven't got enough. But there was $3 billion of tax dollars that just disappeared.
Of course.
And no one, they can't find it.
I mean, don't you feel like this is just a systemic problem in government across the board globally?
Yeah, I definitely. I think it's just it comes with, there's that great quote that's like, the best leaders are the ones that don't want to be leaders, right? And the ones that want to be leaders are the ones you should be scared of.
Like the governor in the Walking Dead and Rick. Rick is the doesn't want to be the leader, but he's leading the way. She doesn't watch the show, so she's always just like, I don't get your references.
I know enough about Rick. I know enough about Rick.
I mean, you kind of, Game of Thrones looks at that too, right? Like if you're a fan of that show, is that everybody's battling for the throne. The ones that don't really want it are the ones that are probably better suited to run it, right?
Right.
Okay. So, but I'm gonna.
You just like to give me shit.
I'm gonna do something very amazing here, and I'm actually gonna connect all of this back.
Oh, okay? I love it. Let's go.
Because it's happening. So, I think part of this I want to say is that I said this the last time we talked to you, which was that when I started watching The Culture High, what I didn't realize was I thought I was watching. I was gonna see a film about, you know, why pot should be legal.
Right.
Right. And I ended up watching a film that really had nothing to do with that at all, that was more about sort of uncovering this, you know, mystery as to why it's illegal in the first place and what how that happened. And I think that to me was so eye-opening, particularly the part about crime and our prisons and the statistics on who's going to jail and what those crimes are and all of that. And to me, like, the problem is that nobody's able to look at that and see that that's an issue of culture that goes back to how people are treated and how they're raised and what their resources are and whatever. And nobody wants to see that. And it's like, that's what's so fucked up to me is that we've just been talking about all this time about all the things that go into creating, making a person and how the way they see the world evolves. That's what we've been talking about, right? That's an issue of. And nobody wants to, that's the root of the problem right there.
You hit the nail on that. You hit the nail on the head, and I'm glad the film really resonated with you.
Oh, yes.
That's the way Brett, the director, was going for. Is like, how can I make this different than a regular pot doc? I want to make it deeper, great. You know, much more thought-provoking. And to get into that was to look at human culture. Why have we segregated ourselves into one side or the other? Why do we look at this as either prohibitionists or, you know, legalizers, right? When you step back and look at, like, why are we fighting so hard over this one item? Mm-hmm. You start looking back that it really comes back to human culture, right? And that people want to defend their ego and defend their badge of identity. So they will argue it to the death.
Same, which is the same reason why people don't want to admit that white privilege exists. Because if you admit that there is such a thing as white privilege, right? Now, we all know, because we are people who don't think this way, we all know that it's okay to say, you know what? I am white. I do have white privilege. That does not make me a bad person. It just is. This is what I was born into, and this problem exists. That doesn't make me responsible. That doesn't make me bad. That doesn't make me anything. It just makes me white. Okay.
This is when I cut in the Louis C.K. clip about that.
Okay.
You know, lucky guy. I got a lot going for me. I'm healthy. I'm relatively young. I'm white, which thank God for that shit, boy. That is a huge leg up. Are you kidding me? Oh God, I love being white. I really do. Seriously, if you're not white, you're missing out, because this shit is thoroughly good. But let me be clear, by the way, I'm not saying that white people are better. I'm saying that being white is clearly better. Who could even argue? If it was an option, I would re-up every year. Oh yeah, I'll take white again, absolutely. I've been enjoying that. I'm gonna stick with white, thank you.
But people who aren't able to acknowledge it can't acknowledge it because they think that they have to take on some sort of responsibility, that it therefore diminishes their accomplishments. It diminishes who they are because you're implying that it's just because they're white. It's all about ego. And if those people could just say, like, hey, it's cool. It sucks. Yeah. It is what it is.
Well, they probably don't smoke weed either.
It's really hard. You know, it's one of my favorite parts of culture. That's that part where Howard Bloom, the human behavior specialist, that says, he's like, you know, all they are is defending their ego and their point of view, mm-hmm. which means they're really not saying anything,
exactly.
right? They're just defending their point of view. They're really not talking about the issue. They're just constantly, and that's the way, like, it's funny when I look at you know, people of both sides of the argument, legalizers or pro, like, they just are so bent on their way that no matter what, even great arguments come up, they just, they won't even hear, they won't even penetrate because they're already looking to how they can argue the next
point. And not only that, but the, but their, that stance that they, it's all one big fucking vicious cycle because those people have that stance because they have been programmed to believe that pot is so evil and so bad. And that's
they feel like can just talk about logical things. Do you feel like that it, or just listen to somebody say something, even if it's nonsense, you have an opportunity to listen to them? Do you feel like you're going to be infected by the information where you're now going to become a tinfoil hat wearing 9/11 truther or a pot advocate or whatever? I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's all about ego.
On a positive note, we have received for both films thousands of emails from both films positively affecting people for change, where they're like, I look at things very differently.
Yes.
One recent story, which is a great one, is that when we did the Toronto premiere, the night before, I was at a bar and I was talking to this guy that was in the financial world. I won't say his name because he works in a world where he can't. But we were going back and forth, and I was talking to him about, you know, oh, I have a film called The Cult Trial. That's great. What's it about? It's a documentary about cannabis policy and the, you know, and human culture and why we segregate ourselves. And he was like, So he very rationally, not like aggressive or whatever, but he started to bring up arguments. Well, like, what about addiction? What about this? What about that? And I mean, the film was fresh on the top of my tongue, right?
You hit him coming out of a holster. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Got that one.
Drug czars, addiction specialists. So I was just bang, bang. Right. And this is at 3 a.m. in a bar after the drink. I'm just like, bang, bang, bang.
You're like, I'm not even using my memory.
Yeah. And it was really cool because he was like, wow. He's like, I've never heard it put in that way or thought about it in that perspective. And he's like, man, that's very intelligently put. And then I had to call myself out because he was giving me so many calls. I'm like, listen, to be honest, I'm not that smart. I just interviewed the world's best, and I'm using their speaking points from the film, so I sound incredibly intelligent. But I do know what I'm talking about.
Right.
He was like, well, what time is your film playing tomorrow? I'd love to see it. And I was like, well, it's playing at 4:20. And he was like, well, that actually works perfect for me because I have evening meetings, so I'll be there.
Right.
And I was like, perfect. This is a guy that was very anti-cannabis, worked in the financial world, so he brought his team there. And at the end, he stood up and gave a standing ovation. He's like, how do I buy 1,000 copies? Wow. He's like, I was so anti-weed before I came in here. After watching this, it has shaken my world. So not only that, now RBC is interim financing my latest film because they were like, we're not missing your next one. He works for, and now he actually went and got his medical card and smokes occasionally because he's like, man, that's my new drug of choice after learning.
Right.
So when you actually take time to learn and sit back and learn it, like you know, like you said, how it became illegal, why it became illegal, and why we're so viciously fighting it when really it comes down to a human choice thing, right? If you believe in freedom and you believe in freedom of choice, you cannot live in a free society and be drug free. You can't have them both. So you need to look at alternative models that don't incarcerate and punish your citizens, you know, for something that is a personal life choice, just like religion or choosing to eat unhealthy.
Have you seen Reefer Madness?
Of course.
Okay. I couldn't get through it longer than, because it was almost like this weird, like kind of like demented satirical. I was like, what am I watching? This cannot have been something they showed to people in education.
You have to look at it now as a comedy. It is a cult classic comedy.
Oh my God.
Now, that's cool. But amazingly enough, it was funded by Anheuser-Busch and.
Of course.
Yeah. Of
course. Not surprisingly. Let me ask you this. Would you be open to doing a future documentary about 9/11?
If the thing was right, I don't know. There seems to be so many done on that.
Yeah. Like, sure.
There's a lot to make it different. I'd have to really look to see how we could make it different. If the story was there and we could make it different, I'm always open to anything. But it has to be – I'd have to look and see if it's different. That one, to me, I think there's just been so many done.
Even Dylan Avery has done, I guess, like, what, 4 editions of the main film, Loose Change.
Yeah.
Because it kept adding things that they sort of uncovered later, and there were some things that were sort of incongruent and they had to fix. But, I mean, there's a lot out there. I was just curious because it seemed like you had such a great way of storytelling in the Culture High, particularly because again, like I thought it was. I just watch any and all stuff that's on the subject. I also have turned off some stuff that I thought was just, you know, obviously propaganda for the other side. Right. And then, you know, then you have Sanjay Gupta comes out and he's like apologetic and he's done like a couple of different exposés sort of saying, hey, there's obviously medicinal, you know, purposes here. If you just want to get past the recreational side of things. And then it's the weird thing about it is this whole federal government versus the states. It seems like a problem that's really difficult to handle because the federal government never says they made a mistake. They never take laws off the books. It's the whole reason, like, ignorance is no excuse for the law is ridiculous. You can't know all the laws. They never take them away. They just keep adding on to them.
It's a big problem with anyone in power that admitting mistake is very tough. It's easier just to continue pushing, you know, agendas or agreeing and never admitting mistakes. It's a big problem. Wars are started because people cannot admit mistakes.
Ego.
Right?
It all. Where
everyone needs to do an ayahuasca trip.
It all comes back to, but I do want to say, I want to bring it back to the film, you know, the Culture High. I think the impact of the film and the things about that are important to me really kind of are above and beyond marijuana. Like, I feel like you can look at what happened here. You know, by the time we show this, it will be a few months from now. Charleston, right? Show. And all, you know, once again, we're a country talking about guns, talking about race, talking about all these things. And to me, some of the themes of the Culture High, in terms of just looking at our culture and how we treat people and what people are exposed to and how they're raised and whatever, that has relevance to what happened in Charleston.
Well, and here's a really interesting thing that was brought up for me that I'd never looked at. If you look at any of this gun violence, right, all of it, they all have one thing that's glaringly in common that is never brought up. And it's so in your face when I say it right now, it's going to be like, holy shit, I never looked at
it. I already know what it is. It's shitty hair.
But no, that's a part of it. No. Much more apparent than that.
Okay.
Every single one. You go to every mass shooting in almost every country and look at that. They have the exact same thing. So it's not just America. And take a look at, and it says something about, I had to watch this for an anger management course that I recently had to take for a court order. Long story, but
that's hard to believe.
Enough, think about that. Think about the question I put. What do they all have in common that is so glaringly in your face that everybody misses it?
What?
They're all done by males.
Oh yeah. I just read about this the other day.
There was only one psycho killer ever that was a female. Well,
I wasn't sure if that's what you were talking about or not. Yeah, not only are they
I thought you were going to say only children.
Not only are they all male. They're all white. They're all male, okay?
You said globally.
Globally, they're male. If you look, and that's something that was really interesting. I watched, it was is an informational piece that I watched, but it was interesting if it could have been done where it talked about what is it that we do for male culture that makes us so aggressive, right? Like, why are we so prone to being like, because that is glaring, like something, it's never, you hear about medication, you hear about gun laws, you hear about race things, you hear about this, but it's all males, all males, right?
And like, Leslie, the Beltway sniper was not white.
It's, pardon?
Just correcting her thing. I said the Beltway sniper was not white.
Oh yeah, DC sniper. Yeah, it was all males, right? It's part of it comes from the culture of like the male has to be manly, has to be aggressive, has to be all these different things that, you know, looked at it that way. And I had never looked at it from that perspective.
Do you know who Lacey Green is?
No.
Okay, you got to check her out. You're going to love her. Lacey Green is just this really super smart, sex positive, young woman in her 20s, really smart, really well spoken. She started out talking mostly about sex and it sort of has evolved from there. But she did a YouTube video when that kid in, oh God, was in DC that killed these girls because nobody would have sex with him. And so he was
LA.
Okay, is it LA? Okay. She did.
That was a creepy video too. I watched the whole thing.
And she did an episode on how our culture raises men to believe that they are entitled to sex. And so therefore, when they are denied sex, their culture tells them it's okay to get angry. Like these people, yes, they are mentally ill and clearly having some psychosis. But again, that comes from growing up in a culture that taught them over and over and over again that you're entitled to that. You should expect that.
Well, in what ways do you think that that's happened?
in our culture?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of just off the top of my head.
You take a girl out for a date, then she should, I mean, like, why would you not? I mean, that's what we teach men.
Like Porky's, like that type of thing, like that kind of mentality?
No, I'm talking, no.
I'm just saying, I've never been taught by anybody that I should get a handy J because I took a girl out on a Sunday night. I mean, like, I've never thought
We're going to have this conversation another time because this will take a long time to explain to you.
I'm terribly sorry. I gotta drop my wife off to get her vehicle, so I have to cut it short. But I'll be back at my computer here in like an hour or two if that works for you guys.
Or we can do another one on the adult industry when you get a chance.
Dude, I'm totally down. I'd love to get your guys' insight on that.
Yeah, you owned a club? You owned a club?
Former.
Okay. Right.
World's best t-shirt site.